Thank you, Peggy. It is good to see all of you this afternoon. I just want to make a side comment. Y'all can sing. Don't let nobody tell you y'all can't sing. And I do mean that with an A. Y'all can sing. Yeah, you guys sounded pretty. You know how some people think about Presbyterian church. We can't sing that well. Well, y'all can sing. We have been on a journey together this month, and as you notice, I'm up here, Tally Hairston, and not Pastor Lena. She is off helping another church today. We have, though, been in a conversation around theology of creation. And back in July, when the pastors and the preaching team got together, we were thinking about what September would be, and I don't know if we actually thought about all the confluence of events that would happen in the month of September around climate issues. And whether or not you participated in the climate strike this week, or if you just turned the other channel and was like, oh, that's just whatever, I just want to remind us, God has called the church to think about the issues of creation. And oftentimes, I love to reflect in the work of equity that sometimes Christians are great at using the words that the world uses, like intersectionality. But the Bible calls it a theology of holism. Same idea, but it's actually in the Bible. It's not a political word, it's a biblical word, right? Or equity is really, we've all been made in the image of God. We are the Imago Dei, right? That's a biblical idea. And similarly, creation and caring for creation is not a political word. It may be turned into that, it may be used as that, but it is a biblical idea. And it's something that we've been wrestling with, and I love how Pastor Lena has walked into this going, I don't actually know. I'm trying to be informed more by this. And so in our conversations, as you remember last week, Matthew and Colleen Echoha came and just really shared brilliantly with us and informed really a deeper understanding of this work. And having worked with them before, I knew what to expect. And like this week, our guest speaker I've had the chance to work with, and I know you guys are going to be excited about what God is doing in her life. Mary DeYoung is a longtime urban naturalist, eco-theologian, and spiritual accompanist. DeYoung received her master's in theology and creation from the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology with a focus in eco-theology. And as I see, we have our friend, Professor Ron Ruthrup back there from the Seattle School, and good to see you, Ron. She's also received her postgraduate certificate in religion and ecology from Yale's Divinity School and School of Forestry. I bet you didn't know they had that degree. Right? And she's also received an eco psychology degree through Pacifica Graduate Institute. And these have further deepened her theories and practices around nature-based spiritual and social formation. Mary writes guests, lectures, and guides local retreats and international pilgrimages in the category of sacred eco awakening, holding and hopefully responding to the question, how do our faith traditions respond to the reality of climate warming and environmental catastrophe in our time? I have known Mary since 2003. And when I say that I would never invite someone to come speak in front of you all if they hadn't done the work. And when I first met Mary, she was moving into the what we call back in the day when we were kids, the Vista. Right, the Vista, the Rainier Vista. And even though it had gone through a process of gentrification, Mary wasn't a part of, and her husband, Joel, they weren't a part of gentrification in that way. They were a part of transformation. And they took a little greenery space next to their home that when we were kids, we knew not to go into because it was drug infested. It was prostitution, it was crack addicted, it was needles. And Mary began to discover what God could do with green spaces. And the students at the time at Seattle Pacific University and many around the city began to respond. to Mary's passion for the earth. And so we don't have someone before us who hasn't walked the walk and talked the talk, and just talked the talk, but it's rather done both. And I'm excited to have her today to come share what God has put on her heart for us. Will you join me in greeting Mary DeYoung?
Now, we've known each other for a long time. 2003, whew, feels like forever ago. Thank you, Tally. I can't see you anymore. For the invitation into this space and into the conversation. I'm so heartened to hear that this day is a part of a much longer conversation that you've all been a part of. You all have rosemary? Okay. Your work with this herb in the next 20 minutes is just to hold it, rub it, and let's begin to smell it, begin to infuse this space with this scent. Will you pray with me? Creator God, may the words of my lips and the meditations of my heart be acceptable and pleasing to you, my mountain, my forest, my watershed, my sea, our hope, and our Redeemer. Amen. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge my teachers, Redtail Hawk and Sword Fern, Orca Whale and Salish Sea, and the deep, deep indigenous tribal knowledge of the Duwamish Coast Salish people who are here. And their wisdom is still before us, and we would do right to listen deeply. I'm so glad they're in your conversation. And as Tally said, Friday was the start of Climate Week, with the youth leading. Thank you. If the youth are in this room, I know some of them maybe have exited. Thank you. Thank you for wisdom. Thank you for boldness and bravery and courage. So we are having this conversation in that context because we are being asked to have a reasonable response to this time of what eco-philosopher and Buddhist scholar Joanna Macy calls the Great Turning. The Great Turning is a shift from the industrial growth society to a life-sustaining civilization. And what the youth climate strikers are saying, and you've been following, hopefully, the incredible prophetic truth-telling voice of Greta Thunberg, who sailed from Americas to here to give the message that our house, our oikos, right? Oikos is Greek for house, is on fire. And we've got to act like it. She implores it, and she's demanding now climate justice for everyone. And so we start our time with this reality. And it's somber to be sure. The Amazon is on fire. The Congo River Basin is on fire. Oceans are warming. Friday, the New York Times, amongst other news outlets, reported that research has confirmed the number of birds in the United States and Canada has declined by 3 billion since 1970. Scientists estimate that 150 to 200 species of plant, insect, bird, mammal are becoming extinct every 24 hours. It's incomprehensible. This is the age of the Anthropocene, okay? The Anthropocene. This is the age when human activity has become the dominant and degrading presence on this planet. How do we align that reality with our faith? How? How do our theologies, these are our religious stories we tell ourselves about the nature of God, and subsequently ourselves, right? That's a conversation. How we understand God is how we understand ourselves. How do we respond to this ecocide? I'll tell you what is not helpful. And this is where my work is invited to take the church to task a little bit. It's not helpful when we have stories, theologies, that tell us that our planetary home is in heaven. Okay? It's not helpful at all. We need theologies that are functional, in that they tell us the truth of our existence, that we are created from this earth. Let us recall together that Adam in Genesis, the cosmology of creation, in Hebrew, his name is Adama, translatable as ground or earth. And that in this creation cosmology, he is formed out of humus. This is a large group of natural organic compounds found in soil, formed from the chemical decomposition of plant and animal residue. This is from whence we come. And we are part of this earth. We belong to this land. Just as you reflected, it doesn't belong to us. Ultimately, this is a shift now from it being a consuming people to being a communing people, a people who commune and are personally and sacredly connected to our places on our planet. And to lean into this worldview, we need a sound and rooted creation theology, an understanding that God is present in our planet, placed here as a liberating and regenerative, rising, incarnational force for the sake of our human. And I'm gonna use the phrase, instead of creation, I'm gonna use the phrase, the more than human world, okay? So this decentralizes the human in creation. And it says that there is a whole more than human community of beings out there. So this creation theology does the work of a future for all generations. So I want to go to the book of Job for the wisdom it contains regarding how we are to be in relationship with our places and listen intently to the sacred guidance given by the more than human world. So I'm reading from the book of Job, chapter 12, verses 7 through 12, and I'm reading from the Message translation. Hear this. But ask the animals what they think. Let them teach you. Let the birds tell you what's going on. Okay, last week's study that was released. What are the birds telling us about what's going on? Put your ear to the earth and learn the basics. Listen, the fish in the ocean will tell you their stories. Isn't it clear that they all know and agree that God is sovereign, that God holds all things in God's hand? Every living soul, every breathing creature. Isn't this common sense? Read science. Isn't this common science? All as common as the sense of taste, right? So do you hear already how a good creation theology upsets the great chain of being? This is the hierarchical structure that places humanity at the top as the crowning glory. Okay, we're going to do some work at inverting this a bit. It says that the wild ones, the untamed animals, waters, lands, have been given the gift of speech, that they can be read as sacred script, that they have subjectivity and personhood that cannot be controlled, coerced, or conquered. They offer an ecological way of living that is interconnected, interrelational. There is the theology of wholeness. We are meant to court the wisdom of the wild, not corner it, not capture it, reducing its life purpose solely for its value as a commodity for our human use. When we do that, we crush the very presence of God. Okay? So a good creation theology then, hear this, is a decolonizing theology. For at its core, there is a liberation for all human and more than human life that occurs as a result of getting rid of this hierarchical illusion of separation, that we are separate from one another, that we're separate from the earth, that we're separate from the orcas. For it's this illusion of separation, this dysfunctional myth, I'll call it that, is what has allowed the colonizing hubris to take, to desecrate, to oppress. So a good decolonizing creation theology honors, respects, listens to, and affirms indigenous and native voices and a way of living that has been generative and symbiotic for millennia. It joins with the Lummi Nation in saying, what we do to the web of life, we do to ourselves. If any strand of the web is broken, the whole web is affected. A decolonizing creation theology centralizes the voices of the voiceless and unheard, specifically the earth and more than human communities, and gives them dignity and sacred value. Job, but ask the animals what they think. Let them teach you. Listen, the fish in the ocean will tell you their stories. Let the birds tell you what's going on. What do you think, Taliqua? Okay, also known as J35, right, in our resident orca population. What do you think she was saying when she was carrying the carcass of her baby in her grief tour through the Salish Seas in the summer of 2018? Do you think she was teaching us something about the damming practices of our watersheds? Our overfishing practices? How to make the salmon populations thrive? Or what do you think the albatross chicks were telling us with their dead bodies on Midway Island in the northern Pacific Ocean, their bellies filled with plastic? We must retune or attune our ears to those who speak with the tongue of the wild, hearing clearly what they are saying through their silent slide into extermination. I invite you to meditate on this and connect to your own answer. A decolonizing creation theology aligns oppression of the earth with the oppression of bodies and understands that liberation of marginalized people will occur in tandem with the liberation of land. C.S. Lewis rightly said that what we call human power over nature has actually become the power exercised by some people to power over others, but using nature as the tool. Ecological injustice leads to social injustice and vice versa. This is fundamental. When we look to the bodies made invisible by systematic oppression, we see a demonstration of what has been done to the planet. We see the interconnection between the empirical power, okay, and the deforestation and development of the Amazon and the life-threatening impact on indigenous tribes. We must put our ear to the earth and learn these basics. A decolonizing creation theology is a move towards solidarity with the subjectivity of the natural world. Okay, what? What? Solidarity. I'm going to invite you into a different thought between solidarity and stewardship, okay, as part of a different move of how we see ourselves. Subjectivity. We've limited ourselves on how we understand personhood, okay? This is the quality of subjectivity. This is the quality of being. This is the often tied with liberty and justice. Who gets liberty? Who gets justice? And when we limit that understanding, we give personhood only to human beings and corporations. What? Right? This is changing, though, thankfully, with the development of Earth Law. So this is a global movement that is giving personhood back to the planet. In early July, Bangladesh became the first country to grant all of its rivers the same legal status as humans. This is the shift to giving personhood back to the planet. The Ganges River has also been granted this status as well. An Indian court has recognized Himalayan glaciers, lakes, and forests as legal persons. And there are various court cases and decisions like this happening globally, which is exciting because the idea of environmental personhood turns the paradigm on its head by recognizing that nature has rights and that those rights should be reinforced by the court of law. It's a philosophical and I think also a theological idea with indigenous communities leading the charge. So this is the worldview shift that, and this is, I've got it, Ron, Martin Buber. This is the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, whose work we studied ad nauseum at the Seattle School, thankfully, because he talks about a relationship that's an I-thou relationship. This is the seen as the other, as a sacred thou, a holy person in all inherent dignity. And you know what? You can't steward a person. Okay? When we steward a person, we are reducing them to an object. This is where the decolonizing system begins to kind of blow our minds with this. Stewardship is still a power over position. We cannot steward the land, okay? Not if it has personhood. A decolonizing creation theology recovers an indigenous worldview within the Hebrew and New Testament scripture that sees land as central, nature as revelatory, and creation as sacred. The earth is the body of God. We must re-mythologize our sacred stories and elevate them to a planetary and cosmic scale. Our hymn this morning is cosmic in scale. And God does not just reside there. His presence is here. The world becomes a source of the sacred, and it must be profoundly cared for in response to an interanimating connection. Our life, we live because the cosmos lives. We need God to inhabit this place. For such a creation-centered religious interpretation leads to a deep sacramentality of all things. We will grow into the kind of people we are meant to be in so much as we are rooted, connected, remembered within the whole assembly of creation. Take a deep breath. I have about 5 more minutes, maybe 10 to go. The Seahawks don't start till 1:30. Go Hawks. A good creation theology is also common sense theology that understands and affirms the science of ecology. Okay? It affirms the science of ecology, opening us up to think about what is a good climate theology, right? Especially poignant this week. A good climate theology speaks through the elements, demanding attention and action. Psalm 104, verses 3 through 4, you ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers. So we have some messages going on around Florida. How about another element, okay? Fire. The poet Gerard Manley Hopkins writes that the world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out shining like shook foil. Where have we seen shook foil in scripture? I remember Moses and the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. Could this not be the moment when God is saying to us, with each forest aflame globally, take off your shoes, for this is holy ground? Could this not be the moment of transformation when we awake to our deepest calling, a call to bear witness to the holiness of creation? Could climate warming be the very fire that is calling us to take off our shoes, our colonizing ego, our Western mind, our capitalist consumption, and recognize and reconnect to commune with the world as holy ground? Climate theology is a justice for all theology. If our faith communities are not talking about and putting action towards the Amazon fires and the reality, this is a reality of catastrophic climate warming, then we must come to terms with how our faith traditions are complicit with climate change, because it continues to perpetuate and orient a colonizing worldview. And it causes violence. This illusion of separation continues to assert that abundance is for the few and the rich. Black writer and activist Alice Walker, most notably known for her best-selling book, The Color Purple, she has huge impact on womanist theology, understood that the earth will assuredly undo us if we don't learn to care for her, revere her, even worship her, okay? Walker warns, while the earth is poisoned, everything it supports is poisoned. While the earth is enslaved, none of us are free. What is treated like dirt, so are we. We are image bearers of God in so much as we are in communion with the earth and subsequently one another. Just like the Trinity are persons in communion, yeah? We are persons in communion that will live into our interrelated, essential relationships with the earth. A Justice for All Climate Theology attunes and demands our attention to collective response to global deforestation, the EPA's rollback of clean water protections, geez, the frenetic drive to continue to mine for finite energy sources. It goes hand in hand. If you are going to have a good creation theology that connects you to land, land is fundamental to power. You are going to be in conversation with the body politic. Just last week in Seattle City Council, perhaps you're aware that council unanimously passed its first ever Green New Deal. This is affirming Seattle's commitments to ensuring that our city can effectively respond to the climate crisis, transition away from its dependency on fossil fuels, and protect our most valuable residents while building Seattle's climate resiliency. And if you saw any news about this, you would have seen my good friend Jamil Suleiman, who is a Muslim man but dresses up like Jesus, and he calls himself Jesus H. Christ. And he went before council dressed in maybe what we would, you know, imagine Jesus to be dressed like, holding a letter from God, Dad. And in this moment, Jesus H. Christ says to city council, "My dad's upset because I gave you a perfectly good planet. And now Jeff Bezos wants to send you to Mars. We have work to do here, okay? What is good for the world will be good for us," says Wendell Berry. So a good creation theology will speak with birdsong and whale tears. It will speak with the words of wind and fire, and it will speak with twining roots that would have us listen to the wisdom of these voices, and in response, fall in love with our beautiful home, our oikos, our earth. A good creation theology would be about the political and civic work of renewing commitments, of being reconnected, being in communion in such a profound way that we will participate with the heart of the world, directing our living and sacred earth towards life instead of death. Find a way that you can be a part of this week. There's a lot to do, but this week in particular, there's a lot of great opportunities to get involved in this work. So in closing, hear how German poet and novelist Rainer Maria Wilke is in conversation with Job, okay? And how this poetic offering affirms a creation theology that is decolonizing in nature and climate responsive. I believe therein lies our hope. How surely gravity's law, strong as an ocean current, takes hold of even the smallest thing and pulls it toward the heart of the world. Each thing, each stone, each blossom, each child is held in place. Only we, in our arrogance, push out beyond what we each belong to for some empty freedom. If we surrendered to Earth's intelligence, and I'll read into that, if we surrendered to the wisdom of the earth, right, as the body of God, we could rise up rooted like trees. You each have your rosemary still, right? I'm smelling it. I'm smelling it in the room. If you've been in any of my times of sharing, this is my favorite ritual to end kind of a sacred conversation. And it's to bring rosemary into a space as a way of kind of remembering about what this herb means, even in folklore or kind of deep stories. English folklore advises that by slipping rosemary into the pocket of an errant lover, one would be reminded of their vows, okay? And Ophelia confirmed the herb is for remembrance in Shakespeare's Ophelia. And now scientists have actually affirmed that this plant is linked to a better memory. So a recent study has shown that a room infused with rosemary actually boosts intelligence scores. You all have rosemary in hand, and take a deep breath. May that this evoke our memory, but with lament. May it posture us who have been errant lovers of this earth towards humility and away from a continued posture of exploitation and dominance. This is an orientation of a new people, remembering that we are meant to embrace creation in a posture of solidarity. cultivating an ethical responsibility toward the least of these on our planet. Amen.